So not number nothing, but your handout. So
go to your handout. If you look at your handout tonight, this is basically it's a pretty detailed outline. And I don't know if we're going to get over all of this. And we're going to go into a lot more of this. Each point, you'll find that basically it's self-explanatory. And I pretty much outlined from chapter 1 basically to chapter 2 and a little bit past. And then, quick question for you. How old was Moses when he died? 120 years old. How long was Moses, when he went to was in Egypt, how long was he there? 40 years. When he went to the wilderness, how long was he there? Okay, when he was leading the children of Israel, how long? Pretty self-explanatory. The life of Moses is well documented. It is broken up in 3 40-year increments, and it's pretty much amazing. And we know that basically the last 40 years of his life, we know a lot about it. The first 80 years, we have snapshots here and there, and we have some speculations of things if you read Christian or Jewish history. So we don't know everything, but we have a pretty good outline in the book of Exodus of all that happened. So what does Exodus mean? A departure at Exodus. It means a departure of a people. So basically, that's what the book of Exodus means. It's self-explanatory. And I said last week, the reason we're going to teach on this, I said recently, Hollywood had put out a movie. And if I'm not mistaken, the name of the movie is Exodus, Gods and Kings, if I'm not mistaken. And I was reading an article not too long ago, and I said, anytime Hollywood puts out a movie about the Bible, I feel like I need to teach on it to correct a lot of things. Because there's so much error, and I know that recently they made a Noah movie, and then they made a Moses movie, and I hope they stop there because they're just doing more harm than they are good, because it's just a lot of mixed up stuff. I was reading an article, an interview about the main actor in this Moses movie. His name is Christian Bale, and he is an atheist. He does not believe in God. He said, this is a very interesting story, though. Pretty much he does not. He's an atheist, and also the director of the movie, he said it's hard to believe that people actually believe in some of this stuff. And pretty much looking at it as a fairy tale, as fiction, but we take this as a reality. We do. The book of Exodus is something we refer to all throughout Scripture. I mean, who hadn't heard about the Red Sea? And who hadn't, somewhere in life, hadn't referred to that as a great example of deliverance? So we do know that the book of Exodus, it is a story about Israel and their departure away from Egypt. And basically, the Exodus is a great book of deliverance, of salvation, of redemption. And it clearly pictures and proclaims that God does this, that God delivers us, He saves us, He redeems us. We look at the book of Exodus and we can gather from all of those different things that God does that not only for Israel, but guess what? He does it for us too. You will find in the Bible, and many of you know this, 1 Corinthians 10:11 says this, that these things were done for our examples. That we can look at the Old Testament and how God dealt with Israel in Egypt. And has anybody heard what typology is? Typology says Egypt's a type of the world. Pharaoh's a type of the devil. Israel's a type of the believer. And that we look at those things as examples to us. And we can say, just like God brought Israel out of Egypt, He brought us out of sin. He brought us away from the world, away from the devil, away from Pharaoh. So we can glean so much from this because God's great deliverance is pictured for us in all the experiences of Israel. And all of us, many preachers as well as myself, has preached from them, applying them to the New Testament believer. So we can glean things for us as well as New Testament believers. But for us to understand this, to understand the book of Exodus, we got to do a little bit of review. How the children of Israel got there, why they are there, why God sent them there. You know, because a lot of times I've heard this kind of question. Why in the world did God send the children of Israel to Egypt? Was it necessary? I tell you, yes, it was. It was very necessary. God, in His great divine wisdom, had a will, had a direction, and had something He was going to do, and we're going to look at that. But for us to understand this, we've got to understand this right here, that the children of Israel at the beginning of the book of Exodus, or right there at the end of the book of Genesis, that the children of Israel was basically a new people. What I mean by that is, how many people, if you remember, how many people went down into Egypt with Jacob? 70 souls. Not including, we know Joseph was already there, and we'll touch on that in a little bit. So, 70 people went into Egypt, and guesstimated, and there's a lot of different numbers that are thrown out there. How many people end up coming out of Egypt? Around how many? What have y'all read? Is the question. 2 or 3 million. That's a safe estimate. I think that's pretty good. I've read somewhere maybe around 600,000 men, and that would make sense if you consider women and children and all that. Maybe around 2-3 million people. So they went down into Egypt, 70 people, and came out 2 or 3 million, a nation. And we're going to go over that. So you have to keep this in mind. Israel was a whole new race of people, and that race was created God to carry on the godly line of believers, and eventually the bearer of the promised seed, the Savior to the world. So we do understand this. You must follow me. What happened from the very beginning of human history, man had sinned and brought death upon the human race. But to counteract that, God said there was going to be a seed that was going to come from a woman that was going to redeem the world. But we do know this, that God started, and we start in the Bible with Adam and Eve and his son Seth. We know that Seth was chosen there. And then we know all of a sudden the next snapshot we see, we had the great flood. And then we know that God chose Noah. And then later on the line of his son Shem to carry on the godly line of people. But God kept His promise and kept the hope of the promised seed alive throughout people that were righteous and godly. So follow me. You had Adam. You had Seth. You had Noah. You had Shem. But guess what happened? Genesis 11, 1 through 32 tells us that even after the flood, humanity still end up becoming a wicked and depraved, sinful people. We do know that. What happened to Noah when he got off the boat and he planted a vineyard? He got drunk, didn't he? Amen. It's a mess. You know, you look, always, you read the Bible, you always find people that God chooses and some of them mess up. And it's a mess. But we do know that after Noah and after this son Shem, we know that after the great flood and all the human race just has always continued to deteriorate into utter depravity, we do know this, that all of a sudden in the book of Genesis, he did something. He intervened in human history. He did something. He called a man by the name of Abraham. And he let Abraham know this, that he was going to father a whole new race of people and a people that were going to carry on the godly seed. Was Abraham faithful? Yes, he was. Abraham perfect? He made errors, didn't he? Had some things we don't understand and we wonder, but just like any of us, he was a human being. You'll find some faults there, here and there. But we do know that Abraham was chosen to father the whole new race of people, which ended up becoming Israel, because you know Abraham's son was who? Who was Abraham's son? The promised son. Let me put it that way. We have Isaac. Who was Isaac's son? He had two. But who was the promised one God used? Jacob. And Jacob became who? Israel. And that became the nation in Egypt. So we do know that. So let me go over this real quick. God had at least 5 different reasons for creating a new race of people through Abraham. Now I want you to notice these same 5 purposes are true about you as a Christian as well. And we have to follow me here. Number 1, God wanted a people who would love and serve God supremely. His followers were to lead people, were to be people who would give Him their first loyalty. That's why God needed a people in the Old Testament. He needed somebody that would look to Him as God, and that He would look to them as my people. Now, God still does that today in the New Testament. He still, if you're a Christian, He's your one and only God, and you are His people. That's the way it is even today. Another reason that God needed a whole new race of people was, number 2, God wanted a people who would be His missionary force to the world. He wanted somebody that could be a light unto the nations. You ever heard that term? Israel was to be a blueprint of how a nation or a people was to interact with God. They were to be a blueprint. The Jews and Israel, how it all trickled down in the future, were to be a people that were going to be a light unto the nations. Guess what, as a Christian, guess what you're supposed to be? Why did God call you out of sin? Number 1, He wants you to serve Him. Number 2, He wants you to be a witness and a light unto the nations. So there's a parallel here from Egypt, from Israel to the New Testament believer. Number 3, God wanted a people through whom He could send His Son to the world. He couldn't just send His Son through anybody. He had to trust them, didn't He? He had to have a people that He could use and that could facilitate the seed of His Son. Number 4, God wanted a people through whom He could give His written word and the law. Amen. God didn't give the law at Mount Sinai to the Philistines. He didn't do it to the Moabites, and He didn't do it in Egypt. He gave the law to the children of Israel. New Testament, guess who's going to receive the Word of God and do the Word of God? It's going to be the Christian. That's why He brought you out of sin and out of Egypt. Number five, God wanted a people through whom He could demonstrate the truth about life and salvation to the world. And even to this day, you do it all the time. We look at Egypt and Israel and what God did with Israel as an example to you as a believer. They are examples unto us for God's dealing. So now we're at your handout. If you look there with me, under section number one, Israel and Egypt, the oppression of God's people. This will cover chapter 1, verses 1 through 22. If you have any questions, stop me at any time in this lesson and we'll try our best to answer it with the Lord's help. So, God's deliverance is point number one. God had led His people Israel down to Egypt how many years earlier? 215. And I know I actually discovered more about this since I've came here. You know, I've always taken it 430 years. But as you study, it is 215 years that they were in Egypt from the time that they entered in until they left. And it makes sense. And many people do agree there. But there's been a lot of commentaries over the years. It's always said 430. It was 215. Now, is it possible for somebody to go from 70 to 3 million people in 215 years? What has America done in 200 something years? We're pretty big, ain't we? Well, what's in America now? 300 million? Is that right? Guesstimate, is that what? Yeah, that's right. 7 billion in the world, 300 million in America. So that's possible. 215 years, and you're talking about an age before birth control and all those things. They had children. They did. Back in those days, they had a lot of children. And verse 1 lets us know that they went down to Israel. So the question would be, number one tonight, why did God lead Israel into Egypt? Does anybody know? And we'll go over some different ideas as well. Brother Tommy.
Because of their ignoring His word, not knowing Him as God, it also was their, you might say, their worship. That's where they came
in Egypt. So that's well said. That's not wrong. You know, it makes sense. Anybody else have any input? Why did God send the children of Israel down to Egypt? How about this? How was the 70 people that were in the family of Israel? Were they all of them good people? No, they wasn't. They were not all good people. The family of Jacob, actually, when you study the book of Genesis, was at the verge of losing their godly identity. Jacob was getting older, wasn't he? And you had the sons of Jacob. We know the story. You're talking about a family feud. You read about the 12 sons of Jacob. It was a mess. I mean, and even Jacob didn't make all the best decisions. I mean, but you have here the 12 sons of Jacob here. And here it is. You've got some of them. You'll find this. There was a moral decay within the family of Jacob. Among 70 people, you have to follow me here. You'll find in the book of Genesis that all of a sudden the sons were living immoral, violent, and lawless lives. Not, we know that Joseph, we know there was some faithful among them, but they were intermarrying. They were doing things with the Canaanitish people. They were doing things where they were slowly but surely, and at a rapid pace, actually was losing their godly identity. Now, with 70 people, it doesn't take long for 70 people, if they're intermarrying with other nations and heathen people, it doesn't take long to taint the seed, does it? It doesn't take long to do wrong. It doesn't take long for those 70 people to be deteriorating. So the family there, my friend, was being immersed in the worldliness of that environment. They were following, some of them were following the lifestyle of the people who lived around them, of unbelievers, of the Canaanites. And my friends, little by little, they were losing their godly identity, little by little. They were doing things. You can read in the book of Genesis 34, Genesis 37, Genesis 38. And if that's not a good enough example, shows you how the brothers of Joseph was, what kind of people would sell their brother in slavery and then lie to their dad and said that he got eaten by a wild animal? And watch him cry and moan and scream throughout the nights for a missing son that he loved. They were pretty bad people, weren't they? The 12 sons of Jacob, they were not doing good. Not all of them. We know that some, we don't know much about Benjamin, but we do know the other ones were not doing good. They were bad people. So God made three different moves to preserve Israel and His promise. Number one, does anybody know what the first move God did to preserve Israel and His promise? See, the story of Joseph. He sent Joseph. Before, he went as a forerunner before the children of Israel. He went up to Egypt, and what happened to Joseph? Number one, when they sold Joseph into slavery, where did he end up in the first place? Potiphar's house. We know that he had enough integrity that he was almost seduced by Potiphar's wife. He said, no, I'd rather go to jail. Where did he go next? He went to prison. And then next thing you know, we know the beautiful story. He interpreted the dreams of Pharaoh. And here it is. He is second in command of Egypt. Now, that's amazing. That's a rags-to-riches story that none of us knows. That's wonderful. When you read that story in the Bible, we have to comprehend. We had a boy that was sold into slavery, was a slave with the prison, and next thing you know, he's the second in charge of all of Egypt. And we know this, that he preserved. And there, he had a strategy and a structure where he preserved the children of Israel. Number two, God used a famine to drive Israel into Egypt away from the Canaanites' influence. Think about this. When that famine came, they end up going into Egypt away from the Canaanites and away from the Canaanites' influence, so they would not no longer be tainted. But follow me here. Number three, the third thing that often gets ignored, have you ever read anything about what the Egyptians thought about the Israelites? They couldn't stand shepherds. They couldn't stand shepherds. What were the Israelites? They were shepherds. So when God sent them into Egypt, the possibility for them intermarrying within that culture in a mass system was very, very unlikely. Because, as a matter of fact, you're reading the book of Genesis 46 and 34. When the children of Israel go down into Egypt and they're going to go stand before Pharaoh, this is what Joseph told them to do. He said, tell them you look after cattle. Don't tell them that you're shepherds. Because shepherds were looked down on. So follow me here. God's three moves. He wants to preserve the seed. He don't want them intermarrying within the Canaanites' culture. So number one, He sends Joseph before them. Number two, He sends a famine that drives them into Egypt. And number three, my friend, He places the family of Israel beside the Egyptians, the people who considered them, as Genesis 46 and 34, an abomination. That's not a light word, is it? Abomination means they can't stand it. It's nasty. So it's just very unlikely. They taught against men being shepherds. So God knew. He did all this very strategically. He sent these 70 descendants all together, now not counting Joseph, and all the friends. Here it is. They're in Egypt. But guess what eventually happens? They become a people. They inherit a piece of land called, what's the piece of land they inherit? Was a very fruitful land, Goshen. Very fruitful, wonderful piece of land. They are tending to the cattle of Pharaoh there. So here it is. But all of a sudden, as they're growing and becoming a people, verse 6 and 7 says something very tragic happens. Guess what it is? Who dies? Who dies? Joseph. Pharaoh died. Yeah, that's right. Joseph and Pharaoh died. And all the brethren. It says that as well. All those died as well. So all of a sudden we have a mess here. Oh, they're down there in Egypt. But God kept fulfilling His promises because His people down through the generations. Because this is what happened. God caused Israel's population to grow, didn't He? All of a sudden, here it is, the present passage. All of a sudden they begin to multiply. And it's a dramatic picture of God fulfilling His promise that He was going to multiply and make 70 people a nation. Now, what did God tell Abraham He was going to do? He said, I'm going to make of you what? A great nation. What did God tell Isaac? He said this. He said, and I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven. What did God tell Jacob? Same thing. Fear not. Go down into Egypt, for I will make thee a great nation. So we do know this, that in Exodus 1 and 7, the Bible says, and the children of Israel was fruitful and increased abundantly and multiply and waxed exceedingly great, and the land was filled with them. They began to multiply and grow. Just like God promised Abraham. How many knows it doesn't matter where you are, God's promises still stand. If you're in Canaan or if you're in Egypt, God can still fulfill His promises no matter where you are. He told Abraham it was going to happen, and here it is. Through a famine, through transitions, it still happened. So we do know this happened, that all of a sudden, the children of Israel are growing. We know that the Pharaoh died. We know that Joseph died. We know that Joseph's brethren died. So all of a sudden, guess what the Bible lets us know? That all of a sudden there was a what? A new Pharaoh that did what? Knew not Joseph. So we come to the enslavement in section B there, the enslavement of Israel by Egypt. It tells how Israel lost its position and privilege and comfort in Egypt and became a subject to a terrible, ruthless oppression. Was it necessary for them to become slaves? Yes, it was. It made them cry out, didn't it? They were comfortable in Goshen. They were. Do you know sometimes God has to disrupt comfort to get people to do the will of God? Who knows? If David never had a spear thrown in his head, he might have stayed in Saul's house eating grapes all the time. We don't know. Sometimes God will drive you out of the palace into the wilderness and make you focus on Him and do His will. Isn't it amazing how God works with people all the time? He took Joseph from being a shepherd and made him a king pretty much. And he took Moses from being a rich, possibly in the next ruler, I don't know how true that is, but took Moses from being a very great ruler to making him a shepherd. Joseph, a shepherd to a ruler, and Moses, a ruler to a shepherd. God has all different ways of working in our lives. It's amazing. So here it is. The children of Israel, it tells us that Egypt began to persecute and enslave Israel. And it tells us how Israel overcame that persecution. So the cause of the oppression was this. Number one, it was ignorance. If you find that underneath point A, underneath section B, 1A, it says this. That says that a new king that arose that knew not Joseph. So notice this. He did not know Joseph or about the God of history. He didn't care too much about Joseph, how many years ago it was. We don't know how. I mean, there's speculation. Was it 100 years? We don't know how long exactly it was. There's speculation, and you may know more than I do about that. But he didn't know about Joseph. He didn't care about God, about the living God. My friend, notice this, that no person enslaves people if he knows God's person in a personal way. This Pharaoh that arose and was a new king that knew not Joseph, obviously he didn't know God either. How many know slavery's wrong? If anybody knows God, you're not going to enslave people. They do it. I mean, America was wrong when they did it. They're wrong in Africa. They still do it now in Africa. And it's wrong. Yes, brother.
Can you imagine what our population would be right now in 600,000 plus?
It would take out a big, it would be a big hit to the system. It would. So we have to keep this in mind, that this was God's will for this to happen. So he was ignorant. He knew not Joseph. He did not know about the children of Israel, all that happened there. And point B, notice this, he also feared the people because their number and strength. They begin to look at them, and as Israel's population was exploding, growing by leaps and bounds, one day, just imagine my mind, this new Pharaoh's there, he's looking out there in Goshen and saying, man, them folks have a lot of children. That's a lot of them out there. And then he says, you know what? He said, why in the world are they living? Why are they in Goshen living like that anyhow? Who are they? Not? How many knows that the children of Israel look different than the people in Egypt? They were. Do you know that the clean shaven head, all that stuff, it started, that's not wrong, but I'm saying that's how Egypt believed. They shaved their head, shaved their face, shaved their bodies, and did the cult stuff on their eyes. They looked different. The children of Israel was a different people, and they obviously looked different. There's no doubt about that when you study. They obviously looked different as well. So notice this, and he was worried about this. He was worried about their numbers and their strength, but also they were becoming a mighty force of people just by sheer numbers, and the king feared their joining forces with some enemy and attacking Egypt. This is what Pharaoh said. All them people out there, they may join forces with the enemy. I mean, how would it look if you had two or three million people all of a sudden look at the nation beside you and says, look, let's get these guys. It would be a detriment to them, especially them being where? On the inside. So number three, not only that, you've got to notice this. And we have to understand that the king feared them joining forces. But like I said, the Israelites were different from the Egyptians in appearance, in lifestyle, and in religion. The Israelites did not worship the same God as the Egyptians, did they? The Egyptians worshiped everything that moved. They worship water, they worship cattle, they worship frogs, they worship lice. We'll talk about that later. They worshiped each other, basically. It was just a big place of massive worship. What did the Israelites believe in? One God. God called Abraham out from that mess and says, look, there's one God. We're going to worship one God. So there were differences in appearance and lifestyle and religion. And the point is this, is that all of a sudden the Egyptians begin to fear the people, feeling that they are a threat and because they were different in some way. And that causes people to persecute other people. Do you know sometimes just because somebody's different doesn't mean it gives you the right to persecute them? That's how a lot of slavery even started, because it was somebody that was different. And they didn't understand it. So if you don't understand it, you enslave it and you captivate it. That don't never make it right. And that's the same thing happening here. So, and also to notice this, point C, they feared loss. As Brother Tommy just said, how big of a strike would it have been to the Egyptian economy if all of a sudden 3 million people and workers disappeared? Think about it. If all of a sudden a big group of people left, it would have been a major attack to their economy, and if that small nation of people was to disappear. So notice this. This is what Pharaoh did all of a sudden. His first impression was this, that of persecution, that he was going to do. He was going to persecute them and enslave them and force labor for the state upon them in verse 11. This is what he's going to do. Much like we hear of the Nazis with the Jews, basically. All of a sudden, you've got the Egyptians showing up in the Jewish territory there in Goshen. And they're a bunch of SS soldiers. And they're letting the new Israelites... I don't know how they did it. Imagine they knocked on the door. Says, guess what? Everything's about to change, friends. You're going to have taskmasters. This is what you're going to do. You're no longer just going to do what you want to do. You're going to do what we want you to do. So there was this great, all of a sudden, the Egyptians wanted, and they had an objective in doing this. Follow me. They wanted to stop Israel's population and growth by enslaving them. They wanted to do something. They wanted to break their spirits and keep them from bearing children, to cause a number of them to die from hard work and harsh treatment, thereby shortening their days on earth. They wanted to do something to them that was going to completely stun the growth of all of the Israelites. We're going to enslave them. We're going to oppress them. We're going to beat them. We're going to work them to all of a sudden they're not going to be multiplying like they have been, because we're going to persecute them. And all of a sudden, the Bible lets us know they were forced to build what? Two what? Treasure cities. And I give a shot at the names there, but I forgot the... I know one of them's Ramses, and the other one's Pithom or something like that. Now, when the Bible says treasure cities, it's not really talking about treasures. It's talking about storage cities. It could be storage for military stuff. It could be storage for gold. All these different things. So they enforced, they come to the children of Israel. They forced them to build two cities, however long this took. But notice what God does in point B. Overcoming the persecution, God calls the people to multiply even more. Now think about that. We're going to beat them. We're going to whip them. We're going to starve them. We're going to slave them. But guess what? They're still having more children. Isn't that amazing to think about? Now follow me here. The process that the Egyptians was trying to do was to be extreme. They wanted it to be extremely difficult to bear and carry children. Follow me here. Now, can you imagine if all of a sudden you were an Israelite and you found out you were pregnant, and all of a sudden you still had to go out and work in the fields every day from sunup to sundown? You think that'd be tough on a woman? Yes. Any woman that has ever had children, been pregnant, you know how difficult, how the strenuous part is on your body. So to Pharaoh, in their mind, they're thinking, if we enslave and persecute them, certainly they're not going to have as many children. Certainly they're going to be weary in their bodies. Certainly, you know, can you imagine that? But my friend is this, how in the world could the children of Israel still grow if they're being persecuted like they're being persecuted? I'll tell you how. God. That's all it is to it, friends. God's made a promise, and it's going to take more than Pharaoh passing a little law and making them slaves to stop the will of God. Hey, follow me. Pharaoh's saying, this is going to happen. And God said, no, they'll still grow. I'm still going to make a nation out of them. It's going to take more than Pharaoh. So notice this. They begin to multiply even more. So this is what happened. The reaction of the persecutors against God's people, they forced a more ruthless labor and made life very bitter for them. And one commentator said it like this. He gave them animal-like work. They made them work like animals, like dogs, like mules, like cows. They worked them so hard. They did this in two ways underneath a point there. Let me find out where we are on our handout so we don't lose you here. Let's see. At page 2, underneath C, point, it says, in construction. Number 1, he put all these people, even more vigorously, he put them in the field of construction, and the people were forced to make brick and mortar and build whole cities for the Egyptian government. What were the Egyptians known for? Pyramids and all those different statues, things they had. I mean, it's pretty unique stuff to look at, but I'd hate to build it, especially without modern technology. You know it was difficult. Number 2, the Bible lets us know in verse 14, the second part of that verse, and it also made them labor in agriculture. In the field of agriculture, they were obviously forced to plant, tend, harvest, clear new fields, and dig and construct irrigation canals. And my friend, the Bible says this, it uses the word rigor. It said it made them work with rigor. Now follow me, that word rigor in the Bible, it means a fierce, back-breaking, crushing labor that actually causes people and nations to fragment and fracture. It was meant, when they forced all this labor on the children of Israel the second time, it was meant literally to break them down. Egypt did not want them to have any energy, any strength, to have any more children. But guess what happened? The Bible lets us know, point number 3 here, that the second, that was the first oppression. So the second oppression was this. It was a plot of deception. They were still multiplying and having children. So what did Pharaoh say to do? He talked to the midwives. What did he tell them to do? He says this. If you look in your handout, I believe I have it in there. The second oppression, a plot of deception. It says that, notice this, he said in point A, the king ordered the two supervising midwives to have all the baby's boy killed while still on the delivery stool, to kill them without their mothers knowing it, is the context of it. Now, I'll get there in a second, but so basically, two midwives. Now, most likely these two midwives were just the supervisors. They were probably in charge of the other midwives. And he said, this is what Pharaoh says. He said, look, come here. This is what I want you to do, man. We're beating these folks. We're working them night and day. Even the pregnant women, they're still having children. They're multiplying like crazy. This is what I want you to do. Look, every time a male child is born, I want you to kill it. I want you to murder that male. What does that sound like in America? Much like when you study the process they're talking about, it's much like third trimester abortion. Delivering the baby and then killing it. And you know, third trimester abortion, if I'm not mistaken, they delivered the baby up to the head. And then they murder the child then. It's much like that. When the baby was almost delivered, they would kill it. And then all of a sudden, he wanted it to be a deception because he really didn't want the children of Israel. He really didn't want them to know what he was doing. Because, put it this way, if you know the midwife's going to kill your boys, I'm going to try to find a way around that, wouldn't you? He maybe wanted them to explain it away by something natural, something going around, a disease or something like this. I mean, trying some way, I'm sure all of it couldn't be explained away. But that's the context of it, that he wanted to do it by deception. But notice this, overcoming the persecution in point B. The midwives feared God more than they feared the king. So this is what happened. They went in there and they said, I'm sure they talked among themselves. I can't do that. Isn't that natural? Shouldn't that be a natural response for people when it comes to killing a baby? On purpose, I said, I can't do that. That's their context here. They notice they cannot do that. So the mothers were supposed to do, I mean, the midwives were supposed to do this, but overcoming the persecution, the midwives said, we can't do that. We fear God more than we fear man. Isn't that the same thing? Where else do you hear that at? In the New Testament? When the prophet, when the apostles are getting beaten, they said, quit preaching. They said, look, we fear God more than we fear you. Same thing here in the Bible. So, the king called for the midwives and questioned their action. Why had they not carried out his orders? And what did they say to him? No, they didn't say that. They said this, to avoid a direct answer giving a true fact about women who are physically fit, the Hebrew women are vigorous. And they delivered the child, but we can even get in there. Is that true? Very possible. It could be. We don't know. But some people said that they lie. You have to take it and read it yourself for your context how you like. But was it a true fact? Is it a fact today that what he's saying is that he's not like these Egyptian delicate women, you know, who ain't used to pain. These women are out in the fields every day. They got some strength. They have children quickly, is what he says. And guess what? It seems like Pharaoh bought it because he didn't kill them. He didn't put them in prison. We read on down and we find out that God blessed the midwives and continued to bless Israel. It not only did Israel continue to multiply, but they began to multiply. Isn't that amazing? This is how God preserved His people. So the third oppression was this, and you've got to follow me here, verse 22, and also point 4 in your handout there. The third oppression was a murderous law. He went from just talking to two supervising midwives to he actually made a national law in Egypt this. What was the law? Take all the male children, do what with them? Throw them into the Nile River. What's in the Nile River? It's a big old reptile. Alligators, crocodiles. So this is the second, or this is the third oppression. He made it a law in all the land to have all the boys drowned. Guess who the executioners were going to be? Wasn't soldiers. The Egyptian people was the context of this. When it's a national law, what do you say? I'm sure there were some soldiers involved, but he's letting all the Egyptian people know, say, look, I'm giving you the authority. I'm letting you know this is a new law. Take the male children of Israel and I want you to throw them in the river and I want you to kill them all. He made it a national law when you study it. So pretty much he gave the Egyptian people the empowerment that they could walk down there in Goshen and if they found a male child somewhere, a little male boy, that he could walk down to the Nile River and toss him in the water. That's what the context of this is. So, how was this murderous law overcome? By a courageous mother who believed in God. And we'll move on down. And what's Moses' mother's name? Jochebed, isn't it? I guess that's how you say it, Jochebed. And that's who his mother was. So we go on down in our second section there. And this is what we're going to look at. Let's see. The birth of Moses, the picture of a believing, courageous mother. And point one there. She was a Hebrew of Levi's tribe, a slave of the lowest rank and a position imaginable. So understand this. Moses' parent wasn't wealthy people. They were poor slave people. Isn't it amazing that God didn't... You don't have to have money for God to use you. You don't have to live in a mansion or a palace. God can use absolutely anybody. The parents of Moses were therefore slaves when they married. That meant both the mother and the father were slaves. They worked as slave laborers. They were abused. They were yelled at. They were beaten most likely. They were poor. They were poverty stricken. They didn't have a lot of money. But all of a sudden, we know the story about Jochebed. And I want you to follow me here. Do you think that Jochebed knew that Moses was a special child? Or do you think she was just hiding a male child? I'll give you the two opinions on it. Number one, some people say she's just doing her motherly duty and hiding a male child. That's true as well. But also Jewish history testifies to something else. Jewish history, you can take it or leave it, because it's not in the Bible. Jewish history does say that Jochebed and them knew something special about Moses that God had visited with them. So you can take it or leave it. It's not in the Bible, but Jewish history, and the Jews believe that. And if you're an American, you can believe what you want. You're a Gentile. Either or. But they believe that Jochebed knew something special about Moses. Knew that he was going to be special. That she still would have treated him the same, I'm sure. But this is something special. He was going to be the deliverer. One of the greatest men who ever was born to a slave. So think about that. Number two, in your third page there, she was courageous and a righteous woman. Not your third page, but... Yeah, it's still your second page. She was a courageous and a righteous woman. She bore a son. So who was Moses' brother and sister? Who was Moses' sister? Miriam. Okay. Who was Moses' brother? Aaron. So Moses' sister, estimating most likely Miriam, Moses' only sister, was a young lady. And some believe she was somewhere around 13 to 16 years old. It's just a guesstimation. And if you have more accurate information, I will take it. Talking about his brother Aaron, we do know that Moses' only brother, how much older was he than Moses? 3 years older than Moses. So you have Miriam, who is 13 to 16 years old. You have Aaron, who is 3 years older than Moses. And then you have this young boy by the name of Moses that comes into this world. So I want you to follow me here for a few moments. Notice the timing of God. The law to kill all of the male children did not come when Aaron was being born, but came when Moses is about to be born. The deliverer. Do you think the devil knows when God's trying to do something at times? Very possible, isn't it? Now, I'm going to give you some more Jewish history. Believe what you want. Jewish history testifies that Israel was beginning to look for their deliverer. That's what Jewish history says. And Jewish history also says is that the Egyptian sorcerers begin to tell that something was wrong. That's what Jewish history says. Take it or leave it. But do you think it's coincidence that all of a sudden, 3 years after Aaron's born, Pharaoh's like, let's kill all the boys. It's timing. Seems like there's something going on there. That's what it seems like. Now, you can take that or leave it. So can you imagine what it was like for all of a sudden Jochebed one day to find out she's having a child? She's pregnant. All of a sudden, what do you think she's thinking in her mind? If this is a boy, this is going to be a lot of trouble. Now, if this is a girl, you know, she's all right. They let the girls live. But if this is a boy, I bet most likely Jochebed there. She has fear. She has anxiety. What if this is a boy? Can you imagine for 9 months carrying that baby? Don't you think it's obvious she's pregnant? You can't hide a pregnancy but so long. You can't. Just like Mary in the New Testament. You know, I'm sure she didn't announce it to the community at first. But about a few months up the road, you could tell. There's a baby. Same thing here. Can you imagine as she's walking to the field? Don't you think that the Egyptian people, that law is passed? Don't you think people are looking at her and say, I wonder if she's having a boy or a girl? And all of a sudden, 9 months later, she brings this baby into the world. And what does she do? What does she do with Moses for 3 months? She hides him. She probably did that too by the time of year. But for 3 months, yes. I know the to say that those in higher powers, I mean, listen. Was looking like Simeon in the temple, etc. Yeah. Yeah, I believe the Spirit can reveal things to people. I don't doubt that, you know, as far as the Spirit. If the Spirit does it, you know, and those, I do know what you're saying. But, you know, like Simeon in the temple, he's, you know, obviously he was looking for the, he said, oh, I'm not going to die. He was an older man, so he knew it was going to be sometime, you know, before too long. So I do believe, I know what you're saying. I follow you. So that's possible. I mean, if God reveals that to somebody and it is God, then, but this is the thing. If God reveals it to him, it's going to happen if it's true. You know what I'm saying? And if it doesn't happen, that makes them, it makes it not true or makes them a false prophet. So I know what you're saying there. So she did the righteous thing. She hid him for 3 months. Now, how difficult would this have been in a mud hut? Yeah. Well said. I didn't think of that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because maybe the baby's crying and they're saying, well, maybe it's a girl. But, I, you know, and it makes me think as well. Maybe she's walking to the field. Do you have a boy or a girl? I'd be asking, you know. But then again, she may not have went to the field for, you know, that's a lot of questions. Well said, though. They could have sat there and said, maybe that's a baby girl and they're crying instead of Moses. But for 3 months, it got to the place, I guess you can no longer hide the child, could she? It got to the place, there came a day, she delivered, it was a boy, and I don't believe she put a blue ribbon outside. No, she would have kept that a secret, wouldn't she? There was no blue ribbon on the mailbox. She's sitting there, and she said, I'm not going to tell anybody this. We do know for 3 months that she hid the child. Was it difficult? We don't know all the details, but let me ask you this question. What made this mother risk her life for this child? This is a simple question. Love. It should be a natural thing for a mother. It should be. It should be there. You know, it's a shame that nowadays that's not there in a lot of people. They can do things and not think about it. But it should be a natural thing. Love, duty, responsibility, righteousness, justice, the sanctity of life. She's there. She's saying to herself, she's saying, this is my child. I ain't no way I'm going to sit there and let people throw it in the river. Now notice this. 3 months, she hides the child. Notice what the Bible says. The Bible calls him a goodly child. What does that mean? He was pretty, special, beautiful. You know, that's the, it kind of be the term, it's kind of the terminology. It's kind of beautiful, a special child. Something when he looked at it, and what is the, a proper child is what it says later on in the Bible. A goodly child, a proper child. So fair in the sight of God, fair in the sight of man. So here it is. She has great wisdom. She planned ahead and trusted God completely. She came to the point she could no longer hide the child. And I just picture in my mind, here it is. She has the child there. It's coming up about 3 months. Don't you think there was maybe periodic searches throughout the little Goshen? Maybe soldiers walking the streets. Maybe the children of Eden, maybe the Egyptians looking around, looking, they knew she was praying. I don't know all that. But 3 months, she can no longer hide the cry. And one commentator says, and this makes sense, and that strikes, comes on like a light bulb. Some commentator said you could tell a difference if it was a boy or girl cry. I don't know how you can do that. I hear a baby cry at Walmart. I couldn't tell you what the difference is. Now I know Chloe's cry. But I can tell a good difference in that. But I thought that was a little far-fetched. But maybe some people were finer tuned than what we are. I don't know. But how about this? Let me ask you this question. Do you think that Jochebed could trust all of her neighbors? No. Just like it was infamous in the Holocaust that some of the Jews were turning against each other. Why were they doing that? Because they were desperate. Not, you know, they were just desperate people. And if they were actually escaped, the book is called Escape from Camp 14. It's about a man that escaped from a North Korean camp. And he actually betrayed his brother and his mother, and both of them got killed. And they asked him later on, they said, why did you do this? He said, I didn't know what, you know, later on now he developed in his mind. He said, I didn't know what love was. He said, I was promised more food if I told on him. And that's what she did. That's what he did. He said, I feel horrible now. He said, but, you know, he said, if I told on him, there'd be more food. So what if all of a sudden, what if there was, with this law, that there was rewards if you were to turn in your neighbor? Is that possible? Very possible. Very possible. So think about this. Yes, ma'am.
And the reason why I say that is because when you look at the whole picture, here she is not Kim. This is my baby. And you know what? For God, I'm going to respect him as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that she prepared something and put him in it, that not even wanted to just keep doing it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then have her daughter to go out there and watch to see what would become of this child.
Yes, she had great faith. Yes, she did. Had great faith. I agree with you. And that's actually in the handout here in a moment. It addresses the fact that she did all this. So well said. So what did she do? She made a watertight ark-like basket. And in verse 3 of chapter 2, she put Moses in the basket, hid him among the reeds of the Nile River, trusting God to save him. And let me ask you this question. Did she do this? Did she go near Pharaoh's daughters on purpose? Is it possible she knew where they washed at?
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. Jochebed would have known the only way that her little boy could live is if an Egyptian official would protect him. She knew that. So when she turned this baby loose in the Nile River, wherever it was, some people believe it was close to Pharaoh's daughter on purpose, where they would go wash. Notice this. She puts Moses in that basket. She knew the baby was going to be saved if only Egyptian official could help. She had Moses watched over by the older sister Miriam, who was maybe 13 or 16 years old. She does everything she knows and leaves the rest of it up to who? God. Now follow me here. You've got to follow me. There's some things in this life, friends, that you can only do what you can do. And the rest of it you've got to put in God's hands. That's where she was. Jochebed, she said, look, you know what? I'm going to make a place for him. I'm going to make this basket. I'm going to try to put a plan together. But you know what, God? The rest of it's in your hand. And I believe if she did it, or if Miriam did it, when they pushed that basket into that Nile River, she was giving it all to God. I believe that. Yes, Robbie?
That's the serenity prayer,
right? Yeah.
Yeah,
I agree with you 100%. And, you know, like baby dedications, that's basically what we're doing as well. You know, I'm going to do everything I can, but a lot of it's in God's hands. And that's what she's doing here. She's giving it to the Lord. And all of a sudden, watch what happens here. And like Sister said she had much faith. Hebrews 11:23 says this, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw that he was a proper child and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. So we see faith there, don't we? So we do see that. And listen, number 4, she witnessed the sovereign guiding hand of God. So here it is. Pharaoh's daughter discovered the ark-like basket in verse 5. She opened the basket and was moved with compassion for the crying baby. So here it is. Do you think God had his hand in all this? Yeah. Yeah, she could have been. There's obviously a certain calloused approach to the Israelitish people. But when she lifted the top off that basket and heard that baby cry, it seemed like heaven strung the cords on her heart. And she, in the Bible, she said, he's a goodly child, a proper child. And here it is. It's almost like love at first sight, if you don't mind me saying it that way. She has been moved upon. So follow me here. Notice this. So here it is that all of a sudden she opened the basket. She's moved with compassion. Moses' sister, notice this. Did Miriam have to show great courage in coming up to her? Can you imagine being this 13 to 16 year old girl walking up to the Pharaoh's daughter and kind of, you know, that's a big deal back then. You just don't walk up to the princess. She walked up to Pharaoh's daughter. Now notice this, and notice her courage. She goes up to Pharaoh's daughter and walked and suggested the Pharaoh's daughter to have a Hebrew woman nurse the child. And you know what Pharaoh's daughter says, because God's involved in this? That's a good idea. One commentator asked the question is this. Let me ask you this. Was it possible that if Miriam never asked that maybe Pharaoh's daughter wouldn't have been so compassionate maybe? It's possible. We don't know. God used all this in His divine, like a divine display of His power. He's putting it together piece by piece. Pharaoh's daughter agrees under God's sovereign guiding hand. And this is the beautiful thing. I like to say it this way. The baby, the very deliverer. Now, any of the other male children was not the deliverer. Moses was. Moses was the deliverer. He was God's chosen for the certain time. He was born for that time. Isn't it amazing to think about this? That, and all of a sudden the law goes out to kill all the male children. It looks like there is no hope. But all of a sudden, here it is. The very kid that the devil does not want to be born is in Pharaoh's palace. and was going to be nursed by his mother. And like one preacher said, he said he made Egypt pay for his Christian education. It sounds like it was Pharaoh's daughter. And going to pay for it. Isn't that amazing to think about? Now, weaning the child of that day was up to about 2 years old. Now, let me follow me here for a few moments that how her faith was rewarded. But just how all this tied together, it is a very amazing thing. But notice this real quick, that some people believe that Moses' mother watched that child until he was 2 years old. And some people believe that Moses' mother most likely had interactions with Moses maybe through the rest of his life. Don't you think there was a certain bond that was connected there? Don't you think that Moses' mother and the Egyptian princess there kept in touch some? Most likely. A relationship built? Now, don't you think that Moses' mother probably was telling Moses when she could, you know, look, honey, I know they're going to bring you in that palace. I know they're going to shave your head. I know they're going to try to make you like an Egyptian, make you look like one, make you think like one, make you worship the Egyptian's God. But guess what? You're in Hebrew. You're not an Egyptian. You're Hebrew. Had to be longer than 2 years. Many commentators agree with that, that it was longer than 2 years. So God rewarded her faith, Moses' mother's faith. She was employed to nurse the child. Egypt paid for a Christian education. She was paid to nurse the child. She was with them for a long period of time. She saw God work all things out to her good. Her son Moses was not only saved, but adopted by the daughter of Pharaoh himself under God's sovereign hand. Isn't that not an amazing thing? This is how God works. This is what I want you to follow me here real quick. Follow me. Who named Moses, Moses? Pharaoh's daughter. What does Moses mean? Drawn from the water, brought from the water is what it means. So pretty neat, isn't it? Because guess what? He was brought from the water. I don't know if that was real prophetic or not, but it's happened. You know, kind of common sense. We got him from the water, we'll name him Moses. So it is 8:24. It's time to close. And we'll get into the rest of it later.